The spearhead had been thrust through their chest and exited their back with one almighty push. Blood had spurted from the exit wound and then sprayed forward when the spear was pulled back out with that same prodigious strength. Judging by the mess it had made of the roses, the attacker must have received a liberal coating. Then the victim had been dragged past the altar and out into the atrium, and from there to who knew where. The weapon belonged to Ortus. But to whom belonged the blood? You had wet your hands before with the blood of Kitherea's unbeating heart. This was not hers. One possibility was that Ortus had stabbed a third party, and then chosen to abscond for reasons of his own with both their body and Kitherea's. That might be the most plausible explanation, but it was not the simplest. You followed that long, snaking trail back out of the room. It led down the hallway, then turned an abrupt corner into a feeder corridor to an inner ring. You spurred your exoskeleton into a trot, your chilled feet spattered through the still warm blood, and you left cooling crimson prints behind you as you ran. You moved along a dimly lit statuary corridor, between the gilded and bejeweled skeletons of third and seventh heroes dressed in gold and green robes of necromantic office, with amethysts and topazes and emeralds for eyes. You turned abruptly, skidding a little in the blood, through a low service doorway. You had passed through the habitation ring and the storage ring. You were in the engineering and environmental ring now, with the power systems and the life support, and the exhausts and waste. The lights were dim here. There were fewer portholes, and the effect was immediately more claustrophobic, more tubular. Even here, no space was wasted. 10,000 years of memorial meant that even in the sharp yellow shadows of the filtration panels, and past the enormous gurgling vat of the water tank, the inlaid bones of the 9 houses sat forever watching switchboard lights marked things like end effector suck, end effector winnow, end effector sift. Better to decay to powder in the drearber os than keep watch above end effector suck until the end of time. The blood was still wet beneath your toes, although thinning out somewhat. It trailed in a nearly black ribbon down past the filtration rooms, and you followed it out to the exhausts. It dripped down a short flight of metal stairs into a wide, deep room within the station, not so thickly built up with the accretion of computers and mechanisms from upstairs. You could understand the great scope of the Mithraeum in here. Tall, oblong plex windows were set high in the walls, and wads of thermal foam nuzzled up against a little bunker, windowless and solid, with huge valves set in it, travelling up through the walls and into chambers unknown. You did not yet know why the station had an incinerator. As far as you knew, it recycled rather than destroyed its waste. Mechanical arms dangled overhead, waiting to place things into the incinerator via a roof hatch. Partway up the main wall, above the bunker, was a tiny plex-fronted control booth, which you could see no way of accessing. The door must have been somewhere back up the stairs. The blood ended abruptly at the door of the incinerator. As though in a dream, you followed it to its terminus. Set in the door was an immensely thick plex panel, yellowed from old fire, and you peered through it. Ortus the First lay propped against the wall at the back of the incineration chamber. His chest was a neat, bloody void where the spearhead had gone precisely through his heart. It would have meant instant death for a normal human being, even a skilled adept. He lay with his chin lolled down on his chest. There was nobody else in the incinerator with him. The showdown between you and the Saint of Duty was already over. Your enemy had been killed without you laying a finger upon him. You felt dimly cheated. The Saint of Joy and the Saint of Patience were distracted with another matter, that matter being God and a heretical three-way division of saliva. Ianthe had walked away from you, all split lips and gay loneliness. Had she walked less drunk with every step toward the little room where Autus bent over a dead woman? Was his ruined heart a gesture for your benefit? Would she leave so much blood? Would she come here? Autus's corpse heaved for breath inside the incinerator and coughed, though you could not hear the sound. You watched as, trembling, he slapped a hand to hide his nude and livid wound. All around him, the incinerator mechanism rumbled to life. You spun away and looked up. In the protected plex booth stood Kitherea, spotlit by the strong white light from the panels above her, leaning heavily upon some handle within. A dead woman staring at you through dark and filmy eyes, her face freckled with drying blood, petals in her limp ringlets. The flesh was dead, but the hate in that face was alive and well and living. You looked at the walking corpse within the cramped control booth, that wraith of irradiated loathing, and as you were frozen by that gaze, she shouldered forward, moving as though throwing her limbs, moving as though she wore her body weightily as lead, and each joint's flexure meant heaving an enormous mass, and, keeping her eyes on yours, she flipped a switch. The valves groaned and popped with heat. They sounded like the acceleration of some great engine, and Kitherea turned, and with each limb dangling out of time with its mate, she limped away. Within the incinerator, Autus looked at you. In the shadows of the incinerator, his eyes seemed very dark. There was no bloom of necromantic power, nor move to save himself. The third saint to serve the King Undying stared at you with something very like helplessness, lying there with his heart exploded, a man before the flame. You thought that you might gather up his ashes in a box and keep them. You imagined what kind of construct might be made from the bricks and mortar of the bones of a sacred hand, a man who, in an act of sacred transgression, had used another human soul to fire the ravenous battery of his heart. You thought about sleeping for 6 whole hours a night in a bed alone. You thought about proving your sanity to Ianthe, to Mercy, to God. You prepared to follow Kitherea, to run on bare feet back up those stairs, into the filtration rooms, and to head off that loping, shambling cadaver at the pass. You imagined the answer to that mystery. And then you iced your hands over with thick wads of cartilage, slid them into the handle of the door, and pulled with all your might. It did not respond. Living bone burst from your fingertips in grossly exaggerated distal tips, and you snapped them off at their bleeding edge. The pain distracted you, and you screamed aloud to focus. This bone you unfolded into a seething web of phalanges and nuggety clumps of palm bones, pressed into the door. Then those distal tips you turned into fluid, and this fluid you turned into liquid ash a micrometer thick, a very weeny construct. You syruped this broth through the microscopic crack in the door's seam. The incinerator's mechanism ignited somewhere in the vents above you with a thump. The Saint of Duty followed the flow of a nozzle spraying transparent liquid before his feet, and you wrenched the door from its hinges, you tossed it down the breadth of the room in a mad, idiot, beautiful rush, and you walked straight into the petals of a chemical fire. An alarm shrieked overhead as though it too were roasting to death. In the second that you saw the ruddy white surge of flame, you did not know it was hot enough to melt steel. You only saw the steps of what you had to do. One of the arms, with the liquid ash fingertips, had resolved into two skeletons behind you, their outside layers wet with regenerating ash. You rocketed them forward to drag Ortus by the legs. You exploded their spines into a solid wall of regrowing bone, into a rushing avalanche of reeking, liquid, perpetual marrow, plunging it into that fire as a thousand-layered barrier, the fire versus the bone, unfolding and unfolding and unfolding as the flames burned and burned and burned. You stripped the fucking enamel from your own teeth and added that to the squelching, scorching layer. It was the first time, as a lictor, exploding such tonnage of bone into an incinerator's flame, that you looked upon the limit of your power. And that limit still stretched so far out into the goddamn distance that it was out of your sight. The incinerator buckled. The alarm screamed. You grabbed Ortus and pulled him down the side of the room as a mass of hot, melted bone sludged from the door. You dragged him away from that singeing, choking, killing mass, and you laid him against the bulkhead. He was almost totally incapacitated. His eyes were closed. You moved his hands away and looked more closely at that shattered heart. The wounds were closing, but slowly. Far more slowly than you would have expected. His cyanosed lips bespoke terrible effort as his heart knit back together. He was a myriad-old lictor. You did not understand. The saint of duty said, with a kind of hoarse solemnity,
"Fresh blood wards. Every night."
You said, too surprised not to sound like a moron, "What?" He said,
"Can't bleed thalergy. Not fresh thalergy. Thanergy easy. Mixed with thalergy. Much harder. No bone warts. Blood warts. Understand? Fresh blood warts. Each night. Can't break those."
This was all said in staccato, at the apex of each wheezing breath. The incinerator continued to spew out a white-hot lahar of semi-liquid bone, and it smelled ferocious. The saint of duty did not open his eyes. He just concluded doggedly,
"You'll be safe from us."
There were smarter questions to be asked in response. The one that came to you first, and in your defense it was not a bad one, was, "Why?" He did not answer. He buckled as he turned his head and coughed more wetly. Then he reached out, and he put his bloody hand to your head, nearly covering your face, the tips of his fingers to your temples and your cheeks, like a smothering or a benediction.
"I know you're there," he rasped. "Kill me all you like. I would know you in the blindness of my eyes. In the deafness of my ears, as a shadow smudged against the wall, annihilated by light. Stop. Not here. Not now. Let it go, love. I just want the truth. After all this time."
Ortus dropped his hand and said with intent,
"Just tell me. Back then, why you brought along the bat?"
A voice down at the other end of the room bellowed,
"Harrow!"
It was God, at the stairs. Mercy Morn, dishevelled, was beside him. A few steps behind was Augustine, even more dishevelled, with lipstick on his collar. Ortus did not continue. You stood, the air sizzling the ends of your hair, slapping your face. The Emperor stood on the bloodied steps opposite you, amid the wail of the alarm. The incinerator wheezed dolefully. Someone was moving in the little plex office, and then clanked off. With a sudden white shock to the sinuses, the bone gunge melted to fine powder, and then, as you looked, dwindled to invisible soft dust. You said insistently, "Why, I brought along what? What do you mean?" But Ortus had opened his eyes now, with all their bizarre green sweetness, and he was staring up through you and up through the ceiling, as though he could see through the very hull of the Mithraeum, and he looked up and beyond you, and he said no more.
How much God believed your side of events? How much you believed in relating the story, hot with adrenaline and regret and the helpless, self-doubting rage of the psychotic who knew what she saw and was still able to dismiss it, was not clear. He was very weary. The buttons of his shirt had been done up with the wrong buttons in the wrong holes. You were acutely aware of his displeasure, but did not entirely understand it. As God, Mercy Morn and Augustine looked over the incinerator, they left you alone, sitting in the filtration room with Ortus. You did not often trust instinct, but you were not afraid of him then, seeing him sit on an upturned box the same way you were sitting, wiry and empty-faced and defeated. You were just angry.
"You saw what you saw," you said. "You must have seen her stab you. The blow was from the front, with your own spear."
Ortus said, "I don't know."
"You were conscious. You spoke to me," he said.
"I don't know."
"We had a conversation. I want to know what it meant," he said.
"I don't remember."
You looked into his clear green eyes. His expression had not changed, and neither had his voice. You could not keep the disbelieving contempt from yours when you said, "You don't remember." The saint of duty turned his body toward you. He was clutching his rapier, but it was idle, in the crook of his elbow, in more the manner of an abandoned broom than of a weapon ready for war. His eyebrows were very slightly drawn together, a sort of exhausted crinkle. He looked at you, and he said in a voice you had known since you were 8 years old,
"I sometimes forget."
It was the tone, clinical, enamelled, half defensive, half endangered, the tone of someone admitting a final frailty. It was familiar, because you had used it yourself. "Understand, I am insane." Later on, when the Mithraeum was searched, Cytherea's body was no longer on its altar, and God said he could not detect it anywhere on the station at all. When you were back in your rooms, your now familiar, almost welcome, neat and empty rooms, you opened a vein and set about replacing all your bone wards with blood. It took you hours. You did not fully ward the plex outside, which would have needed complex and careful remote construct work, but you placed an extra skein of wards around the interior windows and hoped the quick fix would do for one quiet night. You were standing in your little foyer, blowing a fine grit of bone dust over a wet blood ward, when you heard footsteps outside your rooms. You stood very still and you listened.
"I hope you're happy."
"Not a bit."
"What a farce! What a grotesque, awful, miserable farce!"
"Well, for goodness sake, how was I to know they'd trip the incineration alarm? God, it's always the one you don't turn off."
"As though I meant that."
"If you mean the other, you were in serious danger of over-egging the pudding. Nobody would ever believe you would get that drunk accidentally."
"Piss off," came the response. "I nearly slapped you. Don't you dare use her as a lever ever again, bringing her into it, and your nincompoop brother with her. Almost isn't worth the payment."
"She should be so lucky as to be any kind of use, as she wasn't any in life. Damned proud of my straight face. Oh, Christabel, all is forgiven." "Good night, Mercy,"
My lips are sealed, but if you're going to make deals with the devil, do ask to see the goods beforehand. I hope you choke before I regret it, and I hope you know that one day I'll wrench Christabel's rotten ghost from your corpse and eat her. Where did you stash Kidareya?
More footsteps. A voice rose.
I told you once, and I'll tell you again. I haven't touched her, you vile, condescending son of a bitch.
And then nothing. You ducked back into your room. At last you were able to wrench off the scarf that posed as a dress and button yourself into a nightgown of your own, and you were able to brush your hair and scrape off your paint and wash off the blood from where Ianthe kissed you, and you were able to lie in the silence of the night with your sword beside you and the evening behind you. Next to you, the body said quietly, "The water is risen. So is the sun. We will endure."
Act 4. Chapter 32. 2 months before the Emperor's murder. The 14th planet you were sent to kill was the thriving, phallogenic satellite of a hot little star. It was lush and terrestrial, with a thick carpet of vegetation and plenty of animal life, and nobody particularly wanted to be responsible for taking it out. Unfortunately, it was right in the current path of Number 7, and Number 7, as Teacher put it, would view such a planet like a hot pie. You were the youngest. It was left to you and to Mercy Morn. Kithareya's body had never been found. An attempt was made in those first few days to search for it, but it seemed that the only one still anxious about it was the Emperor. You knew that Augustine suspected Mercy Morn, though you did not know why. Ianthe suspected Autus of squirreling her away, no matter your doubts. "You know," she persisted in saying, "for sex reasons." She had not blamed you for failing to murder him. Surprisingly, nor did the Saint of Patience, who had elusively apologized for his failure to account for the incinerator alarms. You had not seen any great changes between him and Mercy, except that they were fractionally more short-tempered with each other, or between him and God, or her and God. There was no embarrassment, nor any pause when they met at breakfast or in the corridor and clasped arms with the same warmth or lack thereof that they had always shown. The total absence of appropriate shame made you suspect that this had happened between them before, a thought that made you want to give yourself a lobotomy. And, despite the overwhelming disappointment of God, the Saint of Duty had tried to kill you twice since then, but even he seemed to be weary of it. And your wards had held. At the start of your latest excursion, your teacher surprised you. When you landed on the planet's surface and confirmed that the atmosphere was breathable.
"Keep an eye on what you're breathing in anyway," said the Saint of Joy. "Planets are dirty."
She had given you a pack and a water canister and a beeper and told you to go away. There had been no room to land the shuttle at the planet's lush and forested pole, and so you were faced with a short hike.
"You can do it by yourself," said Mercy Morn.
She was snappish and fretful, but Mercy Morn was always snappish and fretful. She had not become any less snappish and fretful in the last handful of weeks, simply abstracted, as though her eyes already looked to the river.
"I'm going to go do the moonlit next door. It'll be covered in reflected thalogy. Time yourself. Don't let it get away. Most of the life on this thing is in the ocean, but if I've made a mistake, don't get eaten by some sort of creature while you're under."
You said,
"Sister, how am I meant to protect myself when I go under?" "I'm not the genius 2-year-old, am I?" she barked.
There were red rings about those hurricane eyes, and she kept wringing her hands together and looking down through her lashes when she spoke.
"I'll be back in about 6 hours. Goodbye."
It was the first time you had been left alone on a foreign planet.
The earth beneath your feet reeked of moisture, and little worms and beetles moved within it. The foliage was a violent effusion of greens, fresh, lemony greens, and dull, dark, piney greens, and, in the middle, dun greens, and a rustling, bristling canopy of leaves. The air was hot and wet, like the inside of a mouth. The sun beat down on your head in gouts of ultraviolet radiation. Your eyes squinted against the light, and the sweat made your hair start to curl thickly about your neck. It very badly wanted cutting now. 2 days ago, God had taken you into his little sitting room and given you a glass of water, which showed that he had learned, and a biscuit, which showed that he lived in optimism. And the Emperor of the Nine Houses had said, "Harrowhawk, when the door comes down behind me, I want you in that room." You had said, "No, Harrow, there has been no progress." "That's fine. I understand, but I want to give you more time. I want you to have a future." You had said, "Augustine the First has trained me in the river. My necromancy there is nonpareil, and has been since the first. When the beast comes, I will be ready to meet it on its turf." God had looked at you, and he had quirked his mouth in something like a smile, and said, "You're even stubborner than I am. I thought I'd cornered the market." There were many days when you felt his disappointment as a vice, as a long-imagined Hessian pressure against the bones of your throat. There were equally as many days when his nightmare eyes relieved your dry exhaustion like a long, chilly drink of water. Your love for God was akin to your love of the beautiful riverbed edge of the Iliac crest. Your love for God was like those moments of reprieve immediately after waking, when you were not sure who you were. Those moments of living in another Harrow's skin, a Harrow who understood everything with a purity of completeness. It was a relief to worship thus. You had once thought your capability for adoration had been consumed when your eyes had bent upon that face in the tomb, dead and irresistible, the interment of beauty. You were relieved to find some scraps left over. You raised the hood of your mother-of-pearl Canaanite robe over your head. The sunshine beat down through it and pattered prismatic light over your face. Birds shrieked above. They were not large creatures, and you were not afraid of them. But you almost pitied them. It was an uncomfortable thing to remove the soul of a planet like this. It would be the first time you had done it, and the first time you had killed any planet alone. The creatures would not die immediately when the planet did, but they would slowly come to change, and in the end they would be Thanagy mutants who could not reproduce. A rather Ninth House death, and the death that came for all flipped planets, in the end. The forest floor was gnarled and uneven. For the first hour you walked stoically, and you sipped your water. When you grew tired, you spent the second hour in the arms of a large, hulking, ambling skeleton, and you had to brush away the branches and leaves as a second skeleton stormed ahead, cutting down all this boil of Thalagy as it went. It was with an ache like nostalgia that you thought of Dreaber and home, that you thought of the vast gyre at the very apex of your temple, which seemed like a pinprick from the bottom tier, that thin, watery cloud of pumped atmosphere and the dead of space beyond. You thought of the murmurous prayers within the chapel. You thought of the Secundarius bell, its booming profundity, its black tongue's clangor, of waking to the clang, 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 as some ancient bell-ringer hyperextended his biceps in trembling sacred eagerness to yank that rope. The body walked beside your construct. The sun did not dry the melted ice upon that indistinctly coloured hair. The moist warmth of the jungle around you did not impede her, and exertion brought no flush to those long, thinly muscled arms, nor to the slender, gracile legs, nor to the dead cheeks. She had been with you very often of late. You saw all the signs of your undoing. You had few months to live. It could be quite easily counted in weeks now. God had been correct. You had not changed. You were not fixed. You were the last lone assailable lictor. The others were now distant from you, looking to the resurrection beast that came to punish their mortal sins and kill their kindly prince. And yet, there, in the alien slather of forest, among the ferns and fronds and greenery arching against a skyline that was a more reticent verdancy paling into navy blue, you could almost believe that you had the capacity to be happy again. You were an unfilled hole, but even a hole might be content in its emptiness. At this point, though you did not know it, you were a mere kilometre from this insubstantial contentment's obliteration. A hole might also be filled with worms. Chapter 33. Into the fourth hour, you realised you were being followed. A very dim awareness of some large presence pierced the curtain of so much other phallogy, and you were instantly irritable. Mercy Morn had failed to gauge the planet's character. It was plain there were large mammals in this region, and you'd have to come up with some way to carefully plant yourself so you wouldn't get chewed on while you severed the planet's soul. Your annoyance turned to suspicion when it became clear that the phallogy signature was following you. It was keeping careful pace about 100 meters behind you, stalking your path. This was not hard. Your skeletons trod heavily. You were leaving a trail that a blind idiot might have followed, in the middle of a dark and moonless night. You went back to being irritated, this time at your own foolishness, and you stopped. You waited in a clearing for your predator. You corked a space over that rich red earth with bone, so that you could stand on a little platform of it with the tip of your sword touching that mat, and not worry that some annelid was about to squirm over your feet. You checked yourself over to make sure that no airborne foreign body was making inroads on your immune system. You pulled your hood deep over your head, and you waited. The phallogy made its approach. You realized with a deep and slithering horror that it belonged to a person. And then a woman was standing at the edge of the clearing. She wore a peaked cap to keep the sun off her dark-eyed, scissor-slash face. A woman in a grey robe, with the ends tied in a fat knot about her middle to keep them from dragging in the dirt. There was a rough canvas bag around her neck, an arresting, festering mass of phanergy amid all that clear and comprehensible life. She had 2 shabby scabbards peeking up over her shoulders, and chin-length, slate-brown hair tucked behind her ears, the colour of ancient tiles in an abandoned temple. Your voice did not feel like it belonged to you when you said, "I saw your corpse." "Well," said Camilla Hecht steadily, "don't tell everyone, or they'll want to see it too." From the distance between you, you considered her. You also considered a body with a ruin for a face, lying on a long length of plastic sheeting. The sobbing, shrieking bird call around you resolved into an indistinct burble, and you raised your hand to your right ear, and your fingers came away thick with blood so dark that it was almost purple. She took a step toward you. You retreated one, equalizing the distance, and she did not close the approach. You looked at the Cavalier of the Sixth, and you bled. A file opened in your mind. Your hand scrabbled within your robes. The exoskeleton gave up 1 of the 22 letters, with a reminder long memorized. "Ismet, to give to Camilla Hecht." This had not troubled you. Many of the letters required impossible contingencies. Now one impossible contingency was standing before you. You gave the envelope to your hulking skeleton, and it crossed the clearing, admirably navigating the lumpen forest floor, to deliver the letter to the previously dead Hecht. She took it, broke open the envelope, read the contents, and blinked. All while you siphoned blood out of your ears. She looked at the letter. She looked at you. She looked at the letter. Then she balled it up between her fists and ripped it to shreds.
Okay, she said finally. And it's coming out your nose.
You wiped your face, quashed your growing annoyance and said,
Am I required to know the contents?
Hecht cleared her throat. You flinched and recited perfectly. For service previously rendered by your house, invoke the rock that remains ever unrolled, and understand that I will both consider your life as inviolate and aid you if I can.
Thanks.
You said, appalled.
I did not.
It was there in black and white, Reverend Daughter. Reverend Daughter was still a little sweet to your bloodied ears, but you said, and knew you sounded irascible,
Then I have been seriously promiscuous with my past favours.
I suppose you thought you owed us, said Camilla. It had been a long time since you had been around those who were not lictors. You grasped for her thoughtlessly with your construct. You were astonished by the speed with which Hecht drew those big, balanced knives from each shoulder and hurled herself at your skeleton like a stone from a sling. Her first sweep with the butt of a knife shattered the ribcage. It coalesced back. You now disdained skeletons not made of permanent ash. She swept in with a foot, aimed at the fragile place beneath the knee, and sent your construct stumbling forward. You said, Cease! But she levered one knife into the base of the spine, severed it, pulled the spine back toward her with a twang, and you heard your voice rise to say,
I need to know you are real!
She kicked the skeleton away from her. It was in two surprised parts, wriggling to fuse back together, slow to understand the damage. Camilla Hecht sheathed her knives with as much speed and fury as she had unsheathed them, and she said, No sudden moves.
I am Harrowhark Nona Jesimus, you said. I am the ninth saint to serve the King Undying. I am his fingerbone. I am his fists and gestures. I am a lictor, Hecht. What hope would you have against me?
None, said Camilla. And then she added calmly, Yet. You were silent. Your head throbbed. The birds were very loud and shrill, and a multitude of smells drifted from the forest, of damp air, of damp earth, of all the things that crept upon it with their insensible quantities of legs and little frondy parts. You sat down on your bone-plated log, and you wiped your face, and you said,
I watched your body be laid out. I examined it myself, and now you are here. 40 billion light-years from the nine houses, and you tell me that you are real.
If you're going to sit around feeling sorry for yourself, you've changed, she said. And then, I'm going to come closer, all right? You watched with cold apprehension as this resurrection approached. She was not puppeted as your mother and father had been, nor was she a seventh-style simulacrum. Her phallogy lit up with the pure combustive light of a strong, healthy human being, and the minute deaths throughout her body, bacterial, apoptotic, autophagic, produced a thanagetic embroidery you could see as easily as her breath heaving within her chest. You startled badly when she dropped to her haunches before you and looked you over coolly. Looked into your left ear, then your right, peered into your eyes, glanced up your nose. Nice intracranial hemorrhage, she said. Kills most of us non-lictors.
You said, Why are you here? Why are you here now? How are you here?
This planet orbits the sanctuary of the Emperor, Hecht, reachable only by necromantic means, and you are dead.
I'm really not, she said, and, after a pause, in her dry, abrupt voice, I came to find you, Reverend's daughter.
You have found me. Tell me for what purpose.
Camilla took the bag from around her neck. She held it between her hands, and you could see her hesitate. She did not appear to be the hesitating type. Her thumb gently stroked the leather thong closing the drawstring neck, rested there lightly, and then she offered it to you. She silently proffered this shabby little bag, about as big as your two hands cupped together, as if it were a casket filled with jewels. You knew before you touched it what was within. What you did not understand was why. You opened the bag and removed its contents before her dark and stony gaze. It was not particularly full. You cupped the thing between your palms and marvelled. It was a cracked piece of human skull, a ridged supraorbital bone and cut-off curve of parietal, a bulge of zygomatic cheekbone, a shard leading down to the maxilla. That was all. As a skull, it was not particularly interesting. Male, early 20s, maybe 8 months dead, but as a reconstruction, it was incredible. The piece had been assembled from fragments, manually, and not by a bone magician. The smallest would have been no bigger than the moon of your cuticle. It had been painstakingly, passionately, laboriously reassembled from the skull of someone who, soon after death, or symptomatically during, had exploded. There were miniature cracks where it had been glued. You turned it over and over in your hands.
Eyes, said Camilla.
A thin stream of blood was emerging from your right lacrimal duct. You wiped it away. Your headache was quite bad now. You said,
You're necromancer,
she said, after a moment's pause.
Yes.
This was also impossible, as the last time you had seen the skull of Palamedes Sextus, it had been speckled with firearm propellant from the bullet that had shattered his face inward. You wiped your left tear duct before the stone-faced cavalier could say a word. You asked,
What do you want from me?
Camilla stood up. The warden's still in there, she said. You waited, with that work of astonishing labour between your hands. After a moment, she said, He's attached to the skull. I want you to confirm. That's all.
That's all.
You beheld the skull again. The six-month-old bone was yet lively with thanagy. All scraps of flesh had been carefully removed. There were no hunks of hair on that pulverized skull, nor fragments of dried brain matter within the parietal bone. You tried to recall Palamedes Sextus, and your ears renewed their liquid assault. When you hastily scanned your brain for the source, you found nothing particularly wrong, and it made you bleed more. You shook blood out of your right ear and said,
Elaborate.
Thanks for not smiling. He's in there, she repeated, a little doggedly, but with the same dry calm. He's a revenant.
You had been too honestly astonished to do anything so coarse as smile or laugh or say, You have got to be kidding me. That is a good one.
No, he's not, you said. A ghost attached to an immobile object, a ghost attached to an immobile object for this length of time, it would have lost coherency and drifted away long ago. He could not walk. He could not speak. He could not perceive. A ghost does not cling passionately for months to a few fragments of skull.
He would, she said.
I'm certain he had a forceful personality, but
no, I mean he deliberately fixed his soul to his body with spirit magic, said the cavalier. We planned for it, in the event of his death. I know he did it because I got the message. I only want to make sure I snagged the right part of the skull. We didn't account for pieces. If he's not in here, I have to go find the others.
You looked up into her face. Camilla Hecht was a closed object with locks and snaps. She had an expression like the rock before the tomb, inexorable, giving nothing away. But her eyes were dark as the grit mixed with the soil, neither grey nor brown, but both. They were the eyes of a winter season without any promise of spring. In comparing the eyes to the face, you saw into a zipped-up agony. And she said, with that same dull, blank, diamond-hard pain, "The cohort took the rest of him away, and I don't know where they have put him." It was not pity that moved your hand. It was open curiosity about the kind of man who would have sealed his soul to his fragmented corpse before he died. You tucked your knees up, and you put the parietal bone lightly beneath the print of your index finger. You scoured every cell of that bone for some remnant soul. And you could find nothing. It was not the first time you regretted your unfamiliarity with spirit magic. You had flayed yourself in writing with the accusation, "Your understanding of flesh and spirit magic is execrable." Now your regrets reached their pinnacle. You were not even sure that your inability to find a dead boy was due to the dead boy's absence or due to your lack of study. You said, "If his ghost in any way travelled to the river, it would have driven him mad. If he released his hold for even a moment, or if he was unable to bear the prison of his bones..." Camilla just looked at you. You relented. "One moment." The 96 puzzle pieces this cavalier called a skull did not warrant what you were about to do. Your construct skeleton you compacted neatly back to a chip of bone, and your exoskeleton you made inert. If you left them, they would crumble to pieces, and it was better not to give her any indication of your vulnerability while you were under. You moved to sit on the grass. It crushed beneath you, and the smell made you anxious. You deliberately did not think about all the insect life squirming and seething beneath the seat of your robes. You planted your feet flat on the ground and made your spine a soft curve. The ghost wards were already painted on your belly and the back of your neck, though they were superstition only, placed for the unseen emergency where you were forced to physically move your body through the river. A mind without its meat would not attract a ravenous ghost. There would be a thronging populace here, all uninterested in you if you were not attached to your bright, delicious flesh. And anyway, you only intended to take the briefest look. You took the weighty sword from your back and placed it beneath your feet, and then you took the partial skull from your lap and you waded into the river. You had intended to use the skull to triangulate its owner. It would be otherwise impossible to pick out one ghost between the billions upon billions, innumerable spirits, a nearly infinite mass, making their way through the dark waters. "Time and space works differently in the river, no matter how you enter, my chicks," Augustine had warned. "Anchor yourself as you're leaving the old meat robes behind and as you wade through the waters. Attach to worldly geography. Be aware of your body. Let it be your harbour, unless you're dying to be pulled somewhere you don't want to go." You used the skull as your geography instead. The water was very cold when it closed over your head. It felt thick and slippery as oil. Augustine had ducked you and Ianthe in the river to train you for this, to get you used to a river teeming with the mad, the insane and the ravenous, and you knew what to expect. You would be in filthy water, with the teeth and the rotten flesh and the bloody, unseeing eyes. You might, if you were lucky, look down upon the mad ghost of the skull. You could discharge your duty by confirming that he had long ago drifted away
and that Hecht might drift away from the buttoned-up, primal grief a ghost story had frozen in place. You prepared for the ice, and the initial panic of ghosts exploding outward from your body, that safe, predatory entry of your brain, the cloudy water, foggy with old blood. And you were standing in a room. Your wet robes were dripping onto a scrubbed wooden floor. The room was penitent-sized, big enough for a bed and a table. Less penitential, the bed was strewn with pillows and cushions and comforters. The table was similarly scattered with preparations, little paper packets and a stained enamel bowl. An old chair was pushed close to the bed, its back restapled to its frame, and some of the stuffing coming out in square, foaming chunks of yellow. Above the bed, a dirty little window that had resisted someone's attempts to clean it looked down upon a dying courtyard where a thick array of salt-choked vines were the only greenish things among an array of spindly, leafless trees. A shelf held a few desiccated books, one standing out like a fleshy corpse among skeletons. Your eyes fell upon the title, The Necromancer's Marriage Season.
It's a historical, said a voice behind you.
A Bellatrine, inevitably of Ida, is considered a poor prospect on the marriage market because she's too skinny. Her tract specialist flesh magic is too good, and she wears her thick chestnut hair in an unflattering bun, which is mentioned at least twice a chapter. You turned around. A man stood in the doorway to the tiny room. He was taller than you. His dull robes lapped around a body of starvation thinness. He was toying with a pair of glasses, and he stared at you with naked eyes of exquisite, pellucid grey. The softness of charcoal burnt nearly white with a glass clarity of quartz. He continued, "There are a few suitors vying for her affections. Though, Abella's such a pain in the arse, I've got no idea why. There's a spoiled swordswoman I'm quite fond of, but the narrative doesn't like her because she goes to sexy parties every night, which I'd regard as a blameless enough hobby. And then Abella meets an insanely tedious widower from the outskirts of Tissis, whose saintly husband ate a grenade in the war. After two massive misunderstandings, they hook up, and then there's a time skip to their adorable baby, who talks with a phonetically impossible lisp and can already form a kidney. The whole is unspeakably sordid." He slid the glasses back onto that beaky nose. "Long time no see, Reverend Daughter." Then he did a very terrible thing. He stepped forward, and he pulled you into a wild embrace, the hold of a man drowning in deep water who cannot help but drag his rescuer down to the bottom with him. He dug his fingers into you in a way you were a little familiar with, tight against the chance that the person in front of you might be a cloud or a mirage. He lifted you off the ground in his impatient, over-familiar eagerness, and then he set you down again and saw your face.
"Excuse me," you said, with sodden asperity.
"Oh, apologies," said Palamedes Sextus. "Misread the moment. Let's call it cabin fever. Nona Jesmus, is Camilla..."
"She sent me," you said, wringing out your wet hem. "She is alive and well and living."
He whistled a sigh. "Oh, thank God," he said, a little unsteadily. "Thank God for that mad, stubborn, lovely girl. Speaking of, Harrowhark, you are a sight for sore eyes."
You frantically clapped your hands to your exoskeleton, but knew as your fingers touched the representation of bone that it was no good. There were no letters there. They could not transfer when you did not know their contents, and there had never, in any case, been a letter addressed to Sextus. The previous Harrow had never bothered to think of it. You knew full well she had seen Hecht and Sextus dead. Why account for one's reappearance, but not the other's? This was a mystery you had no answer for. You were utterly on your own in this nonsensical miracle of a room. You said instead, "A projection? A projection in the river?"
"I'd call it on the bank, though that's not accurate either," he said promptly. "I couldn't anchor myself to my body properly when I was about to render myself down to my component parts, so I established a kind of bubble attached to the riverbank and anchored it to myself at the cellular level. Not one thick rope, but lots of tiny little strings. Like a spider web, I suppose. As long as anyone could find any bit of me, be it never so small and soggy, there'd be a couple of strands still clinging to it, and me on the other end. Oh, that was the hope. Couldn't test it, of course."
You said, "I have been inside the river, Sextus, multiple times, both in spirit and in flesh. You cannot build a bubble there."
"Okay, wrong word, perhaps, but..."
"You cannot build in the river. It is a dimension of perpetual flux. Defined space is nonsense here. You might as well try to wall off time with bricks and mortar."
"Yes, sort of. But by our very presence in the river, we briefly exert space on non-space. Think of how when you blow air into water, you make bubbles. The water can't be where the air is. It's like the air temporarily enforces its own rules over a localized area. If you were in one of those bubbles, you could do things under air rules, like talking or lighting a fire, that water doesn't permit. Like water rejecting air, the river instinctively rejects what lies outside of it. It doesn't want any here in its hereafter, so you can impose your own rules on it, to a very limited extent. I could write at least 6 very good papers about this, Harrow. There's so much work to be done."
You quickly scanned the room again and were struck by its nagging familiarity. You should have known it. You did know it.
"This is Canaan House," you said.
"Moment of death," he agreed. "I said the rules were limited. I can hang on to my sense of self in here, but not my necromancy. I can't do anything. All I have is a single still image of the room, and for some reason, a single romance novel, which I have read upward of 50 times. Thank God I had a pencil in my pocket. I'm in the process of crafting the sequel on a section of wallpaper."
"How much were you able to retain?"
"Look out in the hallway," he suggested.
Cautiously, you stepped out of the doorway. What you had taken for an exit consisted of no more than the view from the door, with some leeway for peripheral vision. It extended maybe a foot in either direction, and then gave way to an enormous white blank. When you walked toward it and pushed,
"Steady," Palamedes warned,
the white was solid, though with a vague, sticky, jellified quality to it. It was an abyssal white. It was an absence, resolved into touch. When you stepped back into the room and knelt on the bed to peer out the window, it was the same. The vision was all the same dead terrace and a sliver of ocean and stone. Craning to look either way revealed that great and terrible whiteness. The window was solid and did not open. You said,
"The barrier begins where your line of sight ended. It's derived from everything you saw,"
he said. "And it doesn't change. The sea is still. It looks like it's moving, but it's not. It's like one of those holographic pictures where turning it up and down lets you see another part of the image. There is nothing here, and that nothing never changes." You sat down on that over-cushioned bed, and you looked up at his long, grave face. You tried to remember if you had ever seen it before it was summarily blown off by gunshot. You really did try. When you closed your eyes, there was nothing cauterized upon your eyelids except a little redness. You said, A human mind cannot live this way, Sextus. Being stuck in place is any revenant's undoing, unless it has a very specific anchor. Eventually it will lose purchase. It will let go. It will return to the river. I cannot imagine the type of mind that would hold on to that edge and keep holding.
I can, and it scares me, he said heavily. Look, how long have I been dead, Nona Jazimus?
8 months, you said, give or take.
He took off those thick lenses and looked at you with diamond-grey horror. His face was homely. He looked somewhat like a beak, a chin and a jaw put together as a joke. But the beauty of his eyes made the whole attractive, as though they were a mould colonising the rest of the stratum. He spluttered,
8 months! I don't have an exact record, but... What? Why did it take you so long? It should have taken you a week, tops. Excuse my apparently sluggard pace, you said, feeling that this was an unjust accusation. But your cavalier only just brought me your bones, and regarding that, I have more than one question to ask her.
His brows were criss-crossing like swords. How did you and Cam get separated in the first place?
I was not aware I owed a debt of care to...
I mean, she wouldn't have left your side if you'd given her half a chance.
You lost your patience.
It was difficult to say if you'd ever had any. You'd just spackled over the hole with curiosity.
Warden of the Sixth House, you demanded. Why are you acting as though I should know you? Why are you acting as though your cavalier knows me? I am Harrowhark the First, formerly and in everlasting affections, the Reverend Daughter of Dreaber. I am the ninth saint to serve the King Undying, one among his fists and his gestures. I did not know you in this life, and I will not know you in the next one.
He stopped dead.
You became a lictor, he said.
That was always the plan.
Not for the Harrowhark I knew. Tell me you did it correctly, he said, and there was a quick, questioning eagerness to his voice, something beneath the confusion. Tell me you finished the work. You, out of everyone, could have worked out the end to the beginning I was starting to explicate. Your cavalier, Reverend Daughter,
has become the furnace of my lictorhood, you said.
The dead warden stopped. He looked at your face as though his eyes could peel through dermis, fascia and bone, and he said quietly, "How God takes and takes and takes." There was an enormous rumble overhead. It sounded like some great mechanism grinding against itself with unlubricated joints, a turbulence of machinery sobbing to life. There came another, farther off, and a bright white light at the window that made you think of the Emperor. Thunder and a sweep of lightning. Palamedes's lovely eyes widened, and he said,
"That's not possible,"
and darted to the window. You went with him. A squall of rain tossed itself at the window like a bird. Through the smeared glass, the still and static light outside was suddenly overcast. You looked down. On the terrace stood a figure in Haz orange, swathed in crinkling safety material from neck to feet. A breathing apparatus obscured the face, and in one gloved hand, clear even from this distance, you saw it. A huge two-bore gun. The figure stared with empty goggle eyes as the wind lashed and as the thunder boomed farther away now. Sextus was saying, "The hell is?" you said, and your voice sounded strange to yourself, as though you had heard the word only in dreams and never articulated by waking tongues. "The sleeper?" The sleeper looked at you both. There came another sudden violent burst of obscuring rain, and it was gone. You and the necromancer of the Sixth House moved as one, shouldered both of your bodies against the door to the room until it shut fast as you slid a crude deadbolt home. You leaned your full weights against it,
This was not a very impressive mass, he said quickly.
Ninth.
This place is powered by one single theorem, held together with the fragility of spirit magic. I cannot manipulate it. I cannot change anything about it, not the room, not the cushions, not the astonishingly shitty book. I can't change a thing about this space, but anyone coming to me could change the parameters, and you've brought something with you that's changing them. Go! Both of you froze as you heard shuffling steps outside the door, a low, asthmatic wheezing from the apparatus. Then you shoved your pathetic necro bodies more forcefully against the door. You said,
Don't be a fool!
Go! And go now, Nona Jazimus!
I'm not about to leave you alone with something I have done, Master Warden.
That's more like the old Harrowhark, but I mean it. Get out. I'm banking on it going with you. I'll be fine. Just tell me, what's Cam got of my bones?
3 inches of right-hand parietal, full right-hand frontal, leading down to...
That's enough. Just so I know what to focus on. Can you change that into something more useful?
You said arctically.
I am a lictor, Palamedes Sextus.
And I'm so sorry about it, he said. Point taken, though. Anything that articulates, okay?
But...
The crash against the door rattled you all